Life is complex. Join us for the simple gifts of wisdom, love, and delight in the written word. The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Part 2 on the Man Called Christ. Chapter 4, The Witness of the Heretics.
Part 2.
We may begin, then, with these two negations. It is nonsense to say that the Christian faith appeared in a simple age, in the sense of an unlettered and gullible age. It is equally nonsense to say that the Christian faith was a simple thing, in the sense of a vague, or childish, or merely instinctive thing. Perhaps the only point in which we could possibly say that the Church fitted into the pagan world is the fact that they were both not only highly civilized, but rather complicated. They were both emphatically many-sided. But antiquity was then a many-sided whole, like a hexagonal whole waiting for an equally hexagonal stopper. In that sense, only the Church was many-sided enough to fit the world. The six sides of the Mediterranean world faced each other across the sea and waited for something that should look all ways at once. The Church had to be both Roman and Greek, and Jewish and African, and Asiatic. In the very words of the Apostle of the Gentiles, it was indeed all things to all men. Christianity, then, was not merely crude and simple, and was the very reverse of the growth of a barbaric time. But when we come to the contrary charge, we come to a much more plausible charge. It is very much more tenable that the faith was but the final phase of the decay of civilization, in the sense of the excess of civilization, that this superstition was a sign that Rome was dying, and dying of being much too civilized. That is an argument much better worth considering, and we will proceed to consider it. At the beginning of this book, I ventured on a general summary of it, in a parallel between the rise of humanity out of nature and the rise of Christianity out of history. I pointed out that in both cases, what had gone before might imply something coming after, but did not in the least imply what did come after. If a detached mind had seen certain apes, it might have deduced more anthropoids. It would not have deduced man, or anything within 1,000 miles of what man has done. In short, it might have seen Pithecanthropus, or the missing link, looming in the future, if possible, almost as dimly and doubtfully as we see him looming in the past. But if it foresaw him appearing, it would also foresee him disappearing, and leaving a few faint traces, just as he has left a few faint traces, if they are traces. To foresee that missing link would not be to foresee man, or anything like man. Now, this earlier explanation must be kept in mind, because it is an exact parallel to the true view of the Church and the suggestion of it having evolved naturally out of the empire in decay. The truth is that, in one sense, a man might very well have predicted that the imperial decadence would produce something like Christianity, that is, something a little like and gigantically different. A man might very well have said, for instance, pleasure has been pursued so extravagantly that there will be a reaction into pessimism. Perhaps it will take the form of asceticism. Men will mutilate themselves instead of merely hanging themselves. Or a man might very reasonably have said, if we weary of our Greek and Latin gods, we shall be hankering after some Eastern mystery or other. There will be a fashion in Persians or Hindus. Or, a man of the world might well have been shrewd enough to say, powerful people are picking up these fads. Someday the court will adopt one of them and it may become official. Or, yet another and gloomier prophet might be pardoned for saying, "The world is going downhill. Dark and barbarous superstitions will return. It does not matter much which. They will all be formless and fugitive like dreams of the night." Now it is the intense interest of the case that all these prophecies were really fulfilled. But it was not the church that fulfilled them. It was the church that escaped from them, confounded them, and rose above them in triumph. Insofar as it was probable that the mere nature of hedonism would produce a mere reaction of asceticism, it did produce a mere reaction of asceticism. It was the movement called Manichaean, and the church was its mortal enemy. Insofar as it would have naturally appeared at that point of history, it did appear. It did also disappear, which was equally natural. The mere pessimist reaction did come with the Manichaeans, and did go with the Manichaeans. But the church did not come with them or go with them. And she had much more to do with their going than with their coming. Or again, insofar as it was probable that even the growth of skepticism would bring in a fashion of Eastern religion, it did bring it in. Mithras came from far beyond Palestine, out of the heart of Persia, bringing strange mysteries of the blood of bulls. Certainly there was everything to show that some such fashion would have come in any case. But certainly there is nothing in the world to show that it would not have passed away in any case. Certainly an Oriental fad was something eminently fitted to the 4th or 5th century. But that hardly explains it having remained to the 20th century, and still going strong. In short, insofar as things of the kind might have been expected then, things like Mithraism were experienced then. But it scarcely explains our more recent experiences. And if we were still Mithraists merely because Mithraic headdresses and other Persian apparatuses might be expected to be all the rage in the days of Domitian, it would almost seem by this time that we must be a little dowdy. It is the same, as will be suggested in a moment, with the idea of official favoritism. Insofar as such favoritism shown towards a fad was something that might have been looked for during the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, it was something that did exist in that empire and did decline and fall with it. It throws no sort of light on the thing that resolutely refused to decline and fall, that grew steadily while the other was declining and falling, and which even at this moment is going forward with fearless energy, when another eon has completed its cycle and another civilization seems almost ready to fall or to decline. Now the curious fact is this, that the very heresies which the early church is blamed for crushing testify to the unfairness for which she is blamed. Insofar as something deserved the blame, it was precisely the things that she is blamed for blaming. Insofar as something was merely a superstition, she herself condemned that superstition. Insofar as something was a mere reaction into barbarism, she herself resisted it, because it was a reaction into barbarism. Insofar as something was a fad of the fading empire, that died and deserved to die, it was the church alone that killed it. The church is reproached for being exactly what the heresy was repressed for being. The explanations of the evolutionary historians and higher critics do really explain why Arianism and Gnosticism and Nestorianism were born, and also why they died. They do not explain why the church was born, or why she has refused to die. Above all, they do not explain why she should have made war on the very evils she is supposed to share. Let us take a few practical examples of the principle. The principle that if there was anything that was really a superstition of the dying empire, it did really die with the dying empire, and certainly was not the same as the very thing that destroyed it. For this purpose, we will take in order two or three of the most ordinary explanations of Christian origins among the modern critics of Christianity. Nothing is more common, for instance, than to find such a modern critic writing something like this: "Christianity was, above all, a movement of ascetics, a rush into the desert, a refuge in the cloister, a renunciation of all life and happiness. And this was a part of a gloomy and inhuman reaction against nature itself, a hatred of the body, a horror of the material universe, a sort of universal suicide of the senses and even of the self. It came from an Eastern fanaticism like that of the fakirs, and was ultimately founded on an Eastern pessimism, which seems to feel existence itself as an evil." Now, the most extraordinary thing about this is that it is all quite true. It is true in every detail, except that it happens to be attributed entirely to the wrong person. It is not true of the church, but it is true of the heretics condemned by the church. It is as if one were to write a most detailed analysis of the mistakes and misgovernment of the ministers of George III, merely with the small inaccuracy that the whole story was told about George Washington. Or as if somebody made a list of the crimes of the Bolshevists, with no variation except that they were all attributed to the Tsar. The early church was indeed very ascetic, in connection with a totally different philosophy. But the philosophy of a war on life and nature, as such, really did exist in the world, if the critics only knew where to look for it. What really happened was this. When the faith first emerged into the world, the very first thing that happened to it was that it was caught in a sort of swarm of mystical and metaphysical sects, mostly out of the East, like one lonely golden bee caught in a swarm of wasps. To the ordinary onlooker, there did not seem to be much difference, or anything beyond a general buzz. Indeed, in a sense, there was not much difference, so far as stinging and being stung were concerned. The difference was that only one golden dot in all that whirring gold dust had the power of going forth to make hives for all humanity, to give the world honey and wax, or, as was so finely said in a context too easily forgotten, quote, "the two noblest things, which are sweetness and light." The wasps all died that winter, and half the difficulty is that hardly anyone knows anything about them, and most people do not know that they ever existed, so that the whole story of that first phase of our religion is lost. Or, to vary the metaphor, when this movement or some other movement pierced the dike between the East and West and brought more mystical ideas into Europe, it brought with it a whole flood of other mystical ideas besides its own, most of them ascetical, and nearly all of them pessimistic. They very nearly flooded and overwhelmed the purely Christian element. They came mostly from that region that was a sort of dim borderland between the Eastern philosophies and the Eastern mythologies, and which shared with the wilder philosophers that curious craze for making fantastic patterns of the cosmos in the shape of maps and genealogical trees.
'Tis the gift to be simple. 'Tis the gift to be free. 'Tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we will not be ashamed. To turn, turn, will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right.